With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week is our very special London Film Festival review show. I'm Sam Howlett, and as always, I'm joined by Kelly Powell.
Hello.
And Jake Cunningham.
Hello.
And we've left the highs of the studio to the lows of Jake's living room.
Yes.
Filled with depressing greys. Looks a bit like a Ken Loach film in here at the moment.
Yes.
Rude. Yeah. It's very beautiful in here.
Yeah, it's an extension of my personality.
So how this show is going to work is we're going to talk about some of the best films that we saw at the London Film Festival, and then we're going to hear from some people who work in Curzon head office to see what they recommend. So Kelly, would you like to kick us off? What did you like at the 62nd BFI London Film Festival?
Well, so much to like. But the ones that really stood out for me were Roma.
Mm-hmm.
As I think that was my favorite of the festival.
Okay.
I just thought it was so, so moving. I cried a lot. Mm. And it's spectacular on the big screen. Yes. I mean, it's just spectacular.
So this is Alfonso Cuarón, and we haven't heard from him for 5 years, since Gravity, which I think, Sam, you might remember, was one of the first recorded conversations that we ever did in our very first radio show.
It was.
Like one of the very, very earliest things.
The sound chaps.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because our second sound, the sound chaps, you'd only know if you were lived in the Canterbury area and happened to listen to student radio, as I'm sure hundreds of you did, tens. Our first episode was a superhero special.
Yeah.
And the second episode was the best of the year.
Hmm.
And we voted Gravity the number one film of the year.
We did, yeah. And because I'm very cool, I had that up there with Upstream Colour
as
well, Shane Carruth film, which I haven't watched since, but I can only assume it's still as good. So we haven't heard from Cuarón for 5 years, and before Gravity it was like a 7-year gap between that and Children of Men. So he takes his time, and I think he's certainly taken his time here, and that has led to his most personal film yet.
Such care, you can tell such care went into that story, and even though like it's slow, you just like get so enveloped in that in the film, like it just takes you on this It really, really puts you in the time and place that it's set. And
From the first shot, it tells you the pace at which you need to consume this story.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting about it is that his regular cinematographer is Emmanuel Lubezki, who people will know as like the hat-trick winning cinematographer of was it Gravity, Birdman, and The Revenant.
Yes.
And he wasn't available to come and shoot this. So for the first time, Cuarón decided to be his own cinematographer.
Really good.
And I think he's going to win an Oscar for it.
Yeah.
It's stunning.
It really is stunning.
Yeah, I believe it's probably currently the second favourite for Best Picture.
It'd be great to see a foreign language film or a non-English film.
Yeah, a non-English language film and a Netflix film.
Mm.
I think Netflix really won an Oscar.
Yeah.
And they're really campaigning hard for this film.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not out here for 2 months, and we're already getting tube posters for that. And Buster Scruggs.
But it's, you know, I reckon it could do at Best Director. If not Best Picture, it could do Best Director. Yeah. That's how they often split it these days.
Yeah.
Which would be interesting. Best Actress as well, people are talking about, because the lead actress is relatively unknown. It's her first film. Best Supporting Actress for the actress of The Mother.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, cinematography. It's all, could all.
Production design.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a probably lived-in film.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It's weird because I haven't seen a trailer for it or anything. I haven't seen it yet. And I really can't, I don't really see how it can be that good from just the posters and everything else. It looks very simple.
It is very simple.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
It is. Yeah, okay. It's so captivating.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, you know, it's based, he dedicates it to the woman who helped bring him up. And it is kind of that story, you know, and it's contextualized in, you know, early 70s Mexico City.
And it's contextualizing his inspirations. Mm. Like there are very not subtle moments where he's referencing his own work.
Yeah.
In particular, there's a moment with Gravity that I think a lot of people don't like. But I think if you are doing this love life letter and it is extremely romantic in its form, I think that's fine to drop that in there. And there's a particular scene in an outside cafe, which people that are familiar with Y Tu Mama Tambien, and quite a pivotal scene in that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's where I recognize that from.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's not in this like meme pool-y way. You get what's going on. It just feels authentic.
Yeah, definitely. And it's so moving and touching because it's so the specificity of it really resonates, I think.
Yeah.
And it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous film. You have to try if you can. I know it's coming out on Netflix, and yes, definitely watch it if that's the only way you can. But if you can get to see it in the cinemas, I recommend that, because you really do just like melt into it.
Yeah. There was a film quiz team called E2 Mama 2 Furious. I saw online the other day. I thought it was really good. Jake, what have you seen then, apart from Roma at the LFA?
So, in a very different way. Sorry, let me do that again. In quite a different experience to Roma, but I want to highlight maybe the films that have been the most experiential. Like, I think definitely with Roma, it felt like this communal experience of everyone in that room. And I had a really fantastic time at the Family Gala, which I think, I can't remember what it was last year, but prior to that it was Goosebumps, and the gala is on a Sunday afternoon. And this year it was Mirai, which is an anime film about a young boy who's his parents have just had another baby, a little girl called Mirai, and he's very jealous of the baby, and he kind of wanders around the house. He's very angry and stubborn, and then in one of his fits he kind of stomps his feet and the house turns into a medieval forest, and the spirit of their dog has become a knight, and then like Mirai from the future is also there, and it's all this like this weird time travel just to kind of set alongside him having to get used to the fact that his family is no longer him. And it's really lovely, and the final 20 minutes are this incredible hybrid of flat 2D traditional animation and new 3D, and there's a swooping 3D tracking shot through a futuristic Japanese train station, and I saw this at the IMAX, and it was the most surreal thing, because it's when that camera started moving, it felt like being in a 3D film, but not
wearing
having
any glasses
or anything. Like the way that James Cameron talks about this is where 3D is going to go, like that is the closest I've had to that experience. And so coming out of the festival with like that, as a single pinpointing a single moment of the effectiveness of cinema, that felt like that. And also that was sold out, and most of the crowd was probably, or like at least 50% of the crowd were 10-year-old kids.
Oh, wow.
And like birthday parties and stuff.
Yeah.
And no one's making a fuss. No one's screaming. No one's throwing their popcorn around. Just completely captivated.
Wow.
And the plot was like, there was bits of the plot that I missed. And there were sharper kids than me who were like, just like saying the plot out loud, as kids do.
Or
saying to their parents, like, why isn't he doing that? And one of them did that. I was like, oh, that's what's going on. Great. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
So, really enjoyed Mirai. And I think that's coming out fairly soon.
Okay.
November.
Yeah.
Well, me and Kelly went to a double bill where there were definitely no kids present.
No.
So we saw Vox Lux, which is the new Brady Corbet film. I think when he was an actor, it was Brady Corbett, but now he's a director, he's Brady Corbett. Mm.
And he is Brady Corbett.
Very good. He is a Brady Corbett.
Yeah, he is.
This is his second film. So he's an actor, now a director. He made his debut a few years ago with Childhood of a Leader, which
Didn't
is very...
Episode on it?
We did. Very impressive debut. Mm-hmm. This is follow-up Vox Lux, which is about a young girl in early 2000s who survives a violent tragedy.
Yeah.
And then when she is videoed singing a song at a funeral, it goes viral and this launches her career as a pop star. So the first half you see her as a young girl, played by Raffi Cassidy, who you'll know from... Killing of a Sacred Deer, yeah. Tomorrowland.
Yeah.
And she's very good.
Yeah, she's very, very good.
Her sister is Stacey Martin, who you'll know from Nymphomaniac.
Yes.
And The Childhood of a Leader. And that's the first half. And then the second half, the film is in two acts, essentially.
Yeah. Five acts, but...
I think it's got like a prologue, act one, act two.
Yeah.
It
goes to five, but...
And it jumps to five.
Yeah.
It's weird.
I think so. But yeah, the beginning is set in 1999 on the cusp of the new millennium, basically. And this tragedy happens and it kind of sets the tone for her, you know, it's a pivotal moment in her development, I think, as a human being. And you can see that, I mean, there was a Q&A afterwards with him. And he described it as she's essentially not the same person from, you know, the teenage her and the older her, played by Natalie Portman.
Yeah.
Who's a superstar and she's definitely changed in a major way from one half to the other. Yeah. And it kind of tracks, you know, the years through the new millennium into now present sort
and
of time.
It's all kind of about the sort of how celebrity culture is like seen as like important as major events in history.
Yeah.
In a way, it's kind of about the sort of
the
tension between those things. Yeah. And Natalie Portman's performance and Raffi Cassidy's performance, they're both incredible.
Yeah.
It feels like they're playing two different characters, which I think is the point.
Yes.
And the first half is very kind of almost naturalistic in the way it looks, and the second half is so colourful and big and loud.
Loud, I think is the word.
And it ends with this really long performance at a massive stadium.
Yeah.
And it's really, I think that's the best part, actually, for me.
Oh, really?
I really enjoyed that last,
I don't know. I didn't know how I was meant to be feeling. It was like a strange,
It's
a weird film, but I think it's definitely, it asks you to question what he's trying to do, which I think sometimes the best films do, like you have to go away and think about what he was trying to do. And I think the Q&A afterwards was great because he's brought up things that made me think even more, you know, like he was saying that these days, the way that people consume news and events as though it is like flipping through a tabloid magazine and of these celebrities. That's just, you know, you scroll through and it's like, oh, 500 dead in this tragedy. And like, oh, okay, what? Oh, and
Kanye West has designed these new shoes. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, very interesting film.
Yeah. So we saw that and then we immediately went to see the new S. Craig Zahler film, Dragged Across Concrete, starring Vince Vaughn and Mel Gibson as two detectives who are suspended after their film being too brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And then they try and make some money outside the law by robbing a criminal and it goes slightly wrong and takes an unexpected turn.
Yeah.
So S. Craig Zahler, this is his third film. And all three of his films have been shown at the London Film Festival. So he did Bone Tomahawk with Kurt Russell and Richard Jenkins and Matthew Fox. Really great, weird horror western.
Mm.
He did Brawl in Cellblock 99 with Vince Vaughn, where Vince Vaughn just beats the hell out of everyone. And now this. And all three films are extremely violent and extremely slow.
Yeah.
Really weirdly paced.
Brilliantly paced.
I think, you know... It's a somewhat problematic film in many respects. Mm-hmm. And I think, without going too much into it, I think you can understand why it's a problematic film from the cast.
From the cast. Yeah, exactly. Well, Mel Gibson is in it.
Well, the fact that Mel Gibson plays a character who's video doing something slightly racist, and then having to kind of deal with that. And
but is it, it's like a satire on that identity kind, as well.
Yeah,
he's like,
I think playing into
the director. The director has said, like, oh, I just hired Mel Gibson because he's a good actor.
Yeah.
I think you can do that anymore. I think if you're hiring Mel Gibson to play this part, you know what you're doing. You're saying something.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's that identity of... It's just a really interesting film. And I think, but if, I think putting that the problematic aspects aside, it's a really great thriller. Really pulpy.
Yeah.
But it's kind of pulpy, but really well-paced. It's not like...
Yeah.
Just full on action. It's really, it's so glacial.
Glacial, yeah, exactly.
And I really like Vince Vaughn.
Vince Vaughn is great in it. I mean, they're great as a duo.
Yeah,
well, they work really well together.
Yeah. So, but I mean, it's just kind of interesting, and it's just kind of like, I can't believe I'm watching a film that Mel Gibson is in, and he's saying these things and doing these things.
Yeah.
There's a kind of
self awareness.
You kind of know it's wrong, but you kind of can't take your eyes off it at the same time.
Yeah.
And S. Craig Zahler's a really interesting director.
Yeah.
He is.
He had some interesting things to say as well in the Q&A afterwards.
So, do you have anything else you guys want to bring up that you've seen at the festival this year that you're looking forward to coming out and talking more about?
I think I was greatly affected by If Beale Street Could Talk.
Yeah.
I kind of had a bit of a moment after that and found myself still like it's easy to be manipulated in the screen in the moment into tears and whatnot. I think the real tell of the kind of emotional power of a film comes when that moment still hits you later on. And like just walking through like down an escalator or across a foyer and then just suddenly remembering a moment and then just it, like, as if I was like back in the room with that. And I want to like go like a lot further into that film, and I will be doing an episode in the new year where hopefully quite a few more of us will have seen it and we can get into that. But I think that's a really incredible piece of work, and Barry Jenkins, like the fact that it feels like Moonlight only just came out, and then not only made another film but another one that is just so powerful so quickly. It's amazing.
Well, it was about this time 2 years ago that Moonlight was just slowly starting to, people suddenly be like, Moonlight could win Best Picture.
Yeah.
People were just suddenly realizing that Moonlight was actually a bigger film than we thought.
Because
when it was at LFF, it was sort of, it was quietly shown. It was in the first, it was the press screen before
even in the I think Beale Street's had the same treatment.
Like, just kind of quietly coming
when,
out.
We went to the Slate presentation for the festival, and then like Beale Street was on a slide with six other films and it was a bit like, and also If Beale Street Could Talk, like, if you've got that film you need to be shouting and I thought, well, maybe that's not a good sign, maybe they don't actually think it's very good or something, like they're kind of just saying we've got the new Barry Jenkins, but it is very good. It's really good.
I really like him as a filmmaker. He's got such a strong point of view,
and the way that he works with faces is incredible. Like, a lot of this film is just people looking into camera, which initially is quite a disconcerting thing we're not used to. And then it makes me think of like cheesy bits like the end of The Revenant and things like that, when people look into camera. But this doesn't feel gimmicky at all. This really feels like you are looking into the eyes of real people.
I can't wait to see that film.
Kelly, you've been talking to a lot of famous people, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
Do you want to talk about some of the famous people you've been talking to some of the famous people we're going to be having on the show in the next year?
Yeah. It was me. Stephen also spoke to a couple of good famous oaks. That was very South African, sorry. I think Alice also did one.
Yes.
So I...
And Jake.
Jake, you squeezed one in. So I did four interviews. But I spoke to Paul Dano for Wildlife, and that was really interesting, and we really delved deep into the film. Great film as well, one that also stands out for me.
That's only in a few weeks' time.
It's coming out soon. Yeah, exactly. Definitely one to go check out on the big screen.
Day not miss it.
Ooh, good.
Yeah, that's all right, isn't it?
Yeah, nice.
Well done. Paul Dano. I spoke to Jason Reitman for The Front Runner.
Is he the right man for the job?
He's the right man for the job.
Two for two.
That was also great to speak to him. He's a lovely chap. And The Front Runner is a really, really good film. I really, really like that film. And I spoke to Maggie Gyllenhaal for The Kindergarten Teacher.
Maggie Gyllenhaal of fame?
Oh no.
That one was
missed it. Sorry. Good effort though.
Yeah, she was great, and we spoke a lot about her character in the kindergarten teacher, and the role of women, you know, in art, and mm-hmm. And that's a very interesting character exploration. That film does kind of suck you in, to her point of view, and you go on this sort of ride with her. Mm. And I spoke to some of the team from Only You. It's a new independent British drama coming out soon.
So that was made by The Bureau. Yes. I think they worked on 45 Years as well.
Yeah. Like, no, Lean on Pete. Yeah. Oh, maybe 45 Years as well, but Lean on Pete definitely. Yeah, they've had some big things out.
Mm, yeah, and this has got Josh O'Connor from God's Own Country, and who is just, as an up-and-coming Brit actor at the moment, he's so exciting.
He's going to be in Les Mis in the West End this year.
Is he? Oh, who's he going to be?
Probably Marius, I imagine. Okay. He's quite a good Marius.
Yeah, he could fit Marius. And he's going to be Prince Charles.
Yes, he is in the Crown. Yeah.
I think that show is so big internationally.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's going to launch this might be the last time we see him in a small
British film. Yeah, exactly. And Laya Costa, is that how you say her name?
Laya Costa. Mm.
Yeah, from Victoria. And she's also in another film at the festival this year, Life Itself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And along with all of that, we've still got other interviews with the likes of David Lowery for The Old Man and the Gun, Peter Strickland for In Fabric, and we've also got Mark Gatiss talking about The Favourite. And so really excited to put all of those interviews out there down the line. But I think maybe it's time to hear from a few folks. Actually, and one special guest, which is Hannah Ryan, who listeners of the show might remember emailed in with her Mamma Mia review a few months ago, and then just popped us another email saying she was in town. Would love to meet up. So we had a quick chat about some of her favourites from the festival too. So I'm sat on the floor of the cinema trying to put together a brief interview with Hannah Ryan for the Curzon podcast here. So Hannah emailed us a few months ago with a fantastic review of Mamma Mia. Here we go again. That was for Much Ado About Cinema, so listeners might remember it. If you don't, go back to that episode and hunt out the link in the description. You can read that review. And before the festival, Hannah got in touch to see if anyone was going to be about to have a chat. And luckily, we'd be able to pin down a few minutes.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
And this, Hannah, is your first London Film Festival.
It is. And it's been a whirlwind so far. I've never quite experienced a week like this. I feel like, I was just saying to you, I feel like I'm trapped in a constant state of lucidity.
Yeah, I said that I this year I'm maybe not as being as maniacal as I have done in the past. That in previous years I've been known to do the three press screenings in the day and then then an evening one as well, and I haven't been quite as harsh on my eyes this year, but as an experience for yourself, it can be fantastic, but at times a bit draining as well.
It can be overwhelming, yeah. And sometimes I think it's nicer to just see one film a day and let it sit with you, you know, to write better or to talk about it better, to kind of let it wash over you rather than sort of be like, because I was at the beginning of the week, I was like, well, I have to see this, this, and this. Yes. But sometimes it's just like, okay, well, I'll see this, and then maybe I'll see this later. It's nice to take a break from it for a bit.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about those ones that have washed over you.
Okay.
What are those ones that have really stuck?
So the one that I can't stop thinking about is Suspiria.
Right.
Has been with me since. Gosh, when did it show now? Was it Tuesday morning? It was, yeah. I really haven't been able to stop thinking about it, stop listening to the score, stop reading about it. It's really sort of captivated me. You know, I feel completely transfixed by it. I just adored it from start to finish and can't wait for more people to see it so I can get involved in a lot of discussion of it. Did you see it?
I did, yeah. I really liked Suspiria.
Yeah.
I think it's, I think maybe it's been given more serious coverage than the film intentionally is made to be.
I think
it's the film's having a lot more fun than some critics might want you to believe it is having.
It's very knowingly ridiculous. Mm. Like, parts of it are just absolutely absurd. Mm. And the humour in there is really intentional.
Yeah.
Yet the trailers, and the way it's being marketed and the way some critics are talking about it is serious, but it forgets how much humour there is in it and how it's very self-aware, which I really like.
I don't think you put Tilda Swinton or Lud Zaberdorf in all of that makeup when you're making a completely straight line film.
No, definitely not. Why go to all that sort of hassle of the whole Lud Zaberdorf sort of thing to just for it to be completely serious? And I think like Luca knew exactly what he was doing with that, which I really admire.
Yeah, yeah. I'm excited to watch that one again. And
Me too.
I've said on the podcast before how much I feel like when a film treads over 90 minutes, it's really got to earn every minute after that. And this is amazing that this, I'm talking about a film that I think is actually a bit of fun, but it's 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
It never really works, but somehow it does in this case.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Not once did I check my watch or anything like that. It just, the pacing is really brilliant in it because it blasts through. Like there was never a point where I was bored or where I felt like it was slogging through. It's just, it didn't feel like 2.5 hours. It went really quickly. And I think it invites rewatches. I can't wait to sort of see it again.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, so that's Suspiria.
Yeah.
What other ones have you been really enjoying or you can't wait to see again?
The Favourite, I think, is so instantly rewatchable.
Mm.
I just know already that I can rewatch it again and again and again and sort of probably not get sick of it. So that was this morning, so that's really fresh in my mind. I like Yorgos Lanthimos anyway, and again it's this similar to Suspiria, you know, it's sort of serious in parts. It's more of a tragicomedy than anything I found, but it's so bizarre, and I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed Emma Stone in it.
Yeah,
she was, I mean, all three leads, so Olivia Colman and Rachel Weisz as well, are all brilliant, but there was something about Emma Stone's performance that really stuck with me because it was so unlike anything else I've ever seen her in.
Mm.
What about you?
Well, Emma Stone is amazing in this film, and I think it's complemented by this really interesting use of a fisheye or wide-angle lens on the film.
Oh,
I think
she's
got such an expressive face. She's got those amazing wide eyes.
Mm.
And once that distorting lens drifts onto her, you can't look away. And it lights up every space in it. And it's quite a gaudy film. Mm. It's quite dark in places. It's a lot of natural light. And so it's not like they can spotlight her like a La La Land to really point focus using that way in any artificial sense. It's really using the characters and the performances to draw you in.
Yeah. There were some like real lingering shots on her face that seemed to sort of go on forever.
Mm.
And in that, you could see so much without, you know, in a single expression. I think you're so right about her expressions. She really excels in that.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved The Favourite.
Yeah, I was surprised how much I liked it. I'm not huge on Lanthimos. I wasn't very keen on Sacred Deer. I thought there was a lot of it I found quite hypnotic and disturbing, but it wasn't one that I felt like I must revisit this straight away, because I found it like quite torturous in a way.
Yeah.
But
it's
The
really
Favourite,
macabre, isn't it?
Yeah. Favorite, you'd almost, the word that comes to mind is delicious.
Yeah,
it is a feast.
It is, yeah. It's just it's a romp is one of the only other ways I can think to describe it. I just had so much fun with it, and it's so accessible. So like, if you wanted to introduce someone to Lanthimos, I would start with The Favorite, and then maybe something like The Lobster, and then I would move them towards Dogtooth.
Yes, and really interestingly, it's the first time he's adapted work not of his own script.
Yeah.
But there's something in it that is inescapably Lanthimos-y, and he's doing a fantastic job in managing to create this this grammar for his directorial style, even when his name might not be on it in every sense.
As usual, that dialogue will become, in years to come, hopefully we'll come up with a term for it, lanthimosian.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a way we could phrase that, but that dialogue is so distinct. Mm. And it was really fun to see. I really loved it. I think it will probably end up being a big award contender.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, a little bit out of left field.
Mm. But I think he's always been on that board. I know Sacred Deer had stuff that never quite hit on that award schedule, but there was definitely talk of it. Came out of Cannes with that original screenplay award. But yeah, I think The Favourite will do really well.
Me too.
Those are two big gala films there. Yeah. I'm wondering, off of the galas, into the maybe other selection of films, any smaller highlights that you'd draw attention to?
In Fabric, I found really interesting. At first I really didn't know what to make of it, because I like Peter Strickland. I really enjoyed The Duke of Burgundy, so I went into it sort of expecting something similar. Did you caught In Fabric? I'm guessing.
I did not.
No, you should. It's a real surprise. It didn't always work for me, but when it did work, it really worked. It was hilarious in parts. It's the only possible way I can think to describe it is Phantom Thread as an absurdist British comedy.
Fantastic.
That's exactly what In Fabric is. It was a real treat. It was a real surprise. And if you're looking for something really unusual and really unique in its tone, I would have a look at In Fabric.
Brilliant. Well, as a preview for podcast listeners, I do know an interview has already been recorded with Peter Strickland, recorded on the day we're recording this, actually, and recorded at 11 a.m. and Strickland requested a nice bottle of red to go with the recording.
That sounds, from his movies, that sounds like something. I'm not surprised.
Brilliant. Hannah, thank you so much for coming on and talking about your favourite LFF films.
Yeah, it's been a blast. Thanks for having me.
Cheers.
All right, we're now joined by Jack Packham from Artificial Eye. Welcome.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good. So what have you seen at LFF this year? What would you recommend?
So on Friday, I managed to catch Diamantino, to a pretty packed out screening of that. It's in the Experimenta strand.
Yep.
And I have to say, it's mind blowing. It's a special film.
It belongs in the Experimental strand.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a real rarity. I was trying to think of like comparisons between the two and with anything else, and it's somewhere between like Dogtooth meets Zoolander. It's wild.
Okay, because I remember hearing about it in Cannes, and all I know is that it's a film about a footballer, and there's giant dogs.
It touches on a bit of everything from populism to fascism to fluffy dogs to gender fluidity between police officers. It has a bit of everything. I think the thing to keep an eye out for is the fluffy dogs that work as a. I don't really want to spoil it too much by talking about it like in depth, but so essentially Diamantino is a world class football player. There you draw. I think this would be a heavy comparison with. I'm not a football fan, but it's a heavy comparison with Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah.
Although they try and draw away from that a little bit.
Yeah.
But essentially, when he plays football, he enters into like a trance where he sees giant fluffy dogs, and not rival players, and is essentially untouchable. The film starts with him being distracted with what's in the midst of the refugee crisis. The night before his called Russia 2018 game, he sees some arrivals there, and it throws him off. It ruins his mojo. And this film's about him trying to find his place after that.
Yeah. Well, okay, that seems bizarre. But it's interesting, like, there's finally this sort of tangible link between people who like art house cinema and people who like football.
Yeah.
Because that hasn't really existed before.
But also similarly with this bizarre sense of humour, which is, I mean, to call it niche is like one thing, but then to say the elements that it touches on are all quite like, there's something for everyone in this.
Yeah.
Everyone in the screening was like at one point, like just in laughter, either on their own at one particular bit they found funny or all in unison at like the general, how the jokes landed. But yeah, I mean, I think it's the only, for a long time, maybe the only Portuguese film I've seen. So I think that's, it's a weird thing to think about, like just on that side of it being like, there's like nothing from that sphere you can compare it to on any level, I think.
Wow. So it's interesting that you can come away from a film and not remind you of anything.
Yeah.
I feel like it's,
I kind of feel like that's what that strand was set aside to do. It's like, come on, let's find something here that is just going to knock people's socks off. It succeeded.
Great. Okay. Diamantino.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Jack. Cheers.
Thanks.
Okay, and we're now joined by Margot Daviot-Fernandez from Curzon's marketing team. Hello.
Hello.
So what have you seen at LFF this year that you really enjoyed?
So on Friday, I went to see Burning.
Yeah.
So that was a Lee Chang-dong film, South Korean thriller. That was quite interesting.
Yeah.
I was very baffled at the end of the film.
Okay.
And I think the people I was with were also quite baffled.
Yeah.
Been thinking a lot about it over the weekend. So it's based on a Murakami short story.
Okay.
And I read the short story over the weekend because I needed more elements, I think. There's a lot to be said. Like the short story is very simplistic. There's not a lot of details. There's no names. The film adds, obviously, like names and a lot more background details to the character. It's quite a long film. It's 2 hours and a half. So it also adds a lot around like South Korean society. So the original Murakami story is based in Tokyo. So there's like this difference. The characters are a bit younger, I think, in the film. So there's a lot more focus on like the youth culture of South Korean society. So there's a lot more elements, but they kind of throw you off like the main storyline.
Because I remember this, it was at Cannes, and it was the favourite to win the Palme d'Or for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that Shoplifters obviously won that.
Yeah.
But this has been, there's a lot of hype around this film.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that I know saw it at Cannes and made sure they saw it again at LFF because they loved it so much, and they said there's so much to unpack. And like, as you say, like you felt that you had to read the short story just to get more from it.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. And I haven't read, like, the short story is originally based on the William Faulkner short story as well, which I haven't read.
Yeah.
So it's like, there's reference to William Faulkner in the film as well.
Yeah.
It's reference to Murakami's work. There's like, the cat, like, it's kind of a constant. There's a lot of like, small details, and it's always throwing you off the main plot, and you're like, ooh, you're kind of waiting all the time, like trying to see, like, is this something? is this important?
Yeah.
And in the end, you don't really get an answer, I think. So it's very much open to interpretation. It's very much around themes of obsession. It's this big mystery around those characters. You doubt everything, and you end up doubting everything like a long time after. It's going to like make you think about it like for a long time.
It was in the thriller sort of section of the festival, wasn't it?
I don't know if it's it was a thrill gala on Friday. I don't know if I would have like really described it as a thriller because it's very mysterious. It's more like mystery than thriller.
There's not
really like a climax of tension or anything. It's very quiet film, it's quite slow, and you're always expecting, like, I guess the tension is there, it's like you're always expecting that something is going to make you go, oh my god, and like some little things do at some point, and then you go, oh no, actually no, it's probably not.
Okay,
so it's very interesting, like, it's very, very interesting tech.
Okay. Well, I can't wait to see it. Like I said, I've been hearing about it for months, about how great it is, and it seems really interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to that one.
Yeah, I mean, like, we've been talking about it this morning with everyone who was there to watch it as well.
It's the talk of the office this morning, isn't it?
So I think people will enjoy it. It's going to make you think and make you talk about it and make you want to go deeper and make you want to understand it.
Mm. Oh, great. Well, Margot, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, and regular podcast contributor Ryan Hewitt joins us now. Ryan, what have you seen at LFF this year that you really liked?
I've seen a number of films, Sam, but one that sticks out in my mind is Ash's Purest White by Zha Zhongke, a Chinese filmmaker who many people may know from A Touch of Sin or Still Life, Mountains Made Apart, most recently. It's a film that really, it centers around a female protagonist, a really, really strong character.
Yeah.
She is, I guess, the mole to a gangster who lives in a working class community in China.
Yeah.
And they kind of run the place, and then a few other heavies try and move in on their territory, right, yeah, try to take a few people out. And there's a really remarkable scene of one moment of martial arts in this film.
Yeah.
But it's brilliant. Okay. It's absolutely fantastically choreographed and entirely believable in an otherwise very realistic film.
Yeah.
There's none of like overly choreographed acrobatics. It feels so grounded,
yeah,
and you believe that everyone involved.
No one's like jumping on a branch.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
It's so sort of, it's so steady, mm, and it's so, got so much tension in it. And anyway, basically what happens is her boyfriend is attacked.
Right.
And he's not going to win the fight.
Yeah.
And she picks up a gun. She goes out into the street. She fires the gun into the air and scares everybody, mm-hmm, off. But is therefore implicated in a crime for carrying a weapon and, right, discharging a weapon in public. It's not her gun. She, though, decides to take the fall for the crime. Mm-hmm. And she spends several years in prison.
Okay.
So that her boyfriend doesn't have to face, yeah, any kind of charges. She does this through loyalty, a really deep and a loyalty that's very, feels like very much part of the traditions that she's brought, yeah, up in, that you don't, right, rat on anyone, that you take the blame for things if you're implicated, and you kind of just face up to it. All under the understanding that when she gets out of prison, mm, her boyfriend will be waiting for her, but he's very much gone.
Right.
He's just disappeared off the face of the earth, started a new life, doesn't want anything to do with her.
Okay.
And so what happens is she sort of, I suppose, in a really quiet revenge, wants to just confront him and make him accountable for having, yeah, being disloyal. And she does so in the most ingenious ways, where she is just completely self-sufficient. She goes around and she extorts men who have been cheating on their wives,
yeah,
and tricks them into giving her money so that she can pay to get to the next part of her journey.
Yeah.
And she, you know, uses all the people and all these guys who, there's like a taxi driver who tries to hit on her, and she just steals his bike and completely ruins him.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. She's completely empowered throughout, all the while riding on this sense of personal injustice and wanting to hold her ex-boyfriend to account, and ultimately remains the most fiercely loyal person despite it all, and really shows everyone around her up for being completely untrustworthy.
Yeah.
And it's a very gentle film. It's apart from the moment of violence,
yeah,
which is quite striking and quite stark, it's otherwise really poetic, and it's really,
okay,
slow and meditative and all those kinds,
yeah,
of things. But it's at the heart of it, just got this brilliant central lead, and you can't take, we are with her the whole way,
yeah,
you can't take her out, your eyes off her. She's completely captivating. There's times when she sort of looks like, she looks a bit like Mia Wallace at times. She's got this bob,
okay, yeah,
really,
yeah,
striking look, and the film moves between feeling like, well, certainly a Westerner's a stereotypical idea of what rural China might be like, and then it goes into really modern moments in discos when you've got people dancing to YMCA,
yeah,
and it feels so contemporary, and,
yeah,
and there's lots of contemporary pop music,
right,
and a couple of songs that repeat themselves throughout and seem to be conveying a kind of a message about enduring love,
okay,
and how hard it is to hold on to it, and how people like her will fight for it, and others will just run at the first,
yeah,
sign of trouble. It's a really terrific film, actually, and but all because of this central character.
Yeah, and performance.
Yeah, it's remarkable, and it's really stayed with me, actually, since of all the films I've seen at the festival, I think it's the one that's lingered the most,
okay,
and has grown the most, all around, just realizing how original she feels.
Yeah, yeah. Great. Sounds like a really good film, actually. Yeah,
it is good. I'd really highly recommend it. I think New Wave are releasing it,
okay,
in the UK.
No, I can't wait for that,
and I would check it out.
Yeah, great. Cheers, Ryan. Thanks a lot.
Cheers.
Okay, so thank you to everyone who's come on the show and spoke about their favorite films. The podcast is out every Friday.
Sometimes earlier.
Sometimes
on how
earlier.
Lazy I'm being.
It will definitely be there on Friday.
Yes.
And if you saw anything at the London Film Festival and would like us to read your thoughts out on air, you can do so by emailing podcast@curzon.com or finding us on Twitter, where we are at Curzon Cinemas. So that is goodbye from Jake.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Kelly.
Bye-bye.
And it's goodbye from me. Thank you very much for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.